a culture war going on in this country, we can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So I'm going to invite you to think about what you're thinking about today. Seek to gain God's perspective on the news and events of the day in order that you can be an effective ambassador of God's perspective in your conversations with others. We invite you to connect with us online. The website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge, hashtag Carmen Talk. Okay, now let me just tell you, if you have already got all of the young people in your church that you can handle, if you are already actively discipling the next generation in a way that they are responding to positively, you already know how to fully equip next generation Christians to be leaders not only in the church but in the culture, then today's show is not for you. If, however, you are in a church that is growing old instead of growing young, if you are one of those people across America who goes to worship on Sunday and there's no one in the entire church that's younger than you, in fact, the average age is creeping up around 70 or 80, this show is for you. Today on the show, we are going to talk about young people. We're going to talk about a moving target depending on your own age. So for you, young people might be anybody under 50. For others of you, young people might be anybody under 20. So we're gonna try to define youth or young adult in this conversation. And we're going to try to discern in a conversation with an expert not only who they are, but what their religious preferences are and what we as people within the church and as Christians in the culture, what we can do to not only reach them and keep them maybe, but to activate them as future leaders in the church and the culture. So we have discussed the millennial generation here with Chris Martin, the author of Millennial Evangelical Blog, and you can certainly find that interview and resources at reconnectwithcarmen.com. But today, when we talk about the word young, we're actually talking about maybe the bottom end of the millennial generation and the top end of the generation that follows the millennials. And so I'll just call that Generation Y because it doesn't really yet have a name. So to talk with us about these important issues is Dr. Kara Powell. She's the executive director of the Fuller Youth Institute. She's an assistant professor of youth and family ministry at Fuller Seminary. She's a former college and church youth minister. She was named by Christianity Today as one of the 50 women to watch, and she's the co-author of Growing Young, Six Essential Strategies to Help Young People Discover and Love Your Church. You can find her work online at fulleryouthinstitute.org, churchesgrowingyoung.org, and you can follow her on Twitter at kpowellfyi. Dr. Powell, welcome to The Reconnect.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's so great to have you on with us to help us understand even who we're talking about when we talk about, you know, young people. We look around in our churches, or at least many people do. They look around in their church and they say to themselves, where are all the young people? Where have the young people gone? And even when they use that terminology, I'm not sure that everybody means the same thing by it. And so let's just start in a conversation about who we're talking about.
Yeah,
because we're not just go ahead.
Oh, at the Fuller Youth Institute, when we say young people, we mean young people ages 15 to 29. So high school students, college age students, and young adults. And for those folks who look around, as you said, at their church and wonder where all the young people are, that's a very common question. Really good research indicates that the average church in the U.S. is aging. 18 to 29-year-olds make up close to 20% of our U.S. population and are only about 10% of U.S. churchgoers. And not only that, but the average church today is also shrinking. No major denomination, no major movement here in the U.S. is Christian movement in the U.S. is growing today. And the percent of those who identify as religious nuns, meaning they don't ascribe to any particular religion, is growing. So it's very common for a church to be aging and shrinking today, and that's why we at the Fuller Youth Institute, we, in the midst of those bare spots, we wanted to study the bright spots, the churches that are doing amazing work with that 15 to 29-year-old age group.
All right, so let's talk about that, because you researched 250 churches, and you discovered what might be called a cluster of attitudes and behaviors that this young cohort, these 15 to 29-year-olds, perceive to be true about churches that they find attractive. So
yeah.
You note that churches, they don't have to be cool, but warm. So unpack that for us.
Yeah, we were able to identify these 250 churches by working through our denominational networks here at Fuller Seminary, as well as with the help of some really key, significant national leaders who were able to point out churches that were doing amazing work. And instead of shrinking and aging, we're growing young. So that's actually what we've called our book, Growing Young. And you're right, we identified six core commitments that these churches held in common. And one of them has to do with the relational climate in the church. When we ask young people to describe what they appreciated about their church, the most common phrase was that it's like family. That's what these 15 to 29-year-olds said. It's like family. And, you know, so often we feel like a church has to be hip or young or cool in order to engage young people. And we certainly had those churches in our sample, but they were by no means the majority. What was more common is what you've just said, that these churches were warm. So as one senior pastor that we talked to during the course of our research said, you know, warm is the new cool. And when I think about that phrase, I think about a church that we studied outside of Philadelphia, church of about 1,500 people. And before we went to that church, the young people were describing how much they loved Bill. And when they thought about the church, they thought about Bill, because Bill was showing up for their games, showing up for their graduations, taking them out to coffee. And so we thought, you know, before we visited the church, we thought, gosh, we want to meet Bill. So we meet Bill, and it turns out Bill is 76 years old. And Bill had a very tough adolescence himself. And so he's determined that no young person at his church is going to experience what he experienced, which was at his major life events, there was no adult cheering him on in the stands. And so Bill is making it a point not only to show up at young people's events, but to recruit other adults, often senior adults, to do the same. So, you know, Bill and the church, they're not particularly hip, they're not particularly young, but they represent that whole idea that warm is the new cool.
Oh, I love that phrase. I hope you're coining it. Warm is the new cool.
Oh, yeah, we are. We love it, too. And the older I get, the more I appreciate it. So
as you were talking about just this, I mean, I just hear, like, the whole concept of the redemption of the concept of family.
Yeah.
And the church, I mean, certainly the church, biblically, is supposed to be the family of God. It's not only the family of faith, it's supposed to be the household of God. And if we could redeem that, wow, we would go a long way to redeeming what the church is supposed to be in the culture in terms of its own calling to actually be the household of God and not just a place where, well, other things might have been happening over generations. I'll leave it at that. I have a family redeeming story to share with you as you were talking about this particular attribute one of the six things that you've identified, this concept of the church feeling like or being like family. I met a gentleman, and this is 20 years ago now, but he was a refugee here in the United States and was in the process of seeking to actually become a citizen. And obviously, you and I know that takes a long period of time. But he was a Christian. He's a Christian. He had immigrated here refugee out of a very serious persecution issue in another part of the world. And he was sharing with us that you know, he never knew his dad, and so his mother was his, you know, primary person. His only experience of family was maternal.
Yeah.
And so he was talking about the value of the church in terms of it being the place where he experienced a father's love. Mm-hmm. And he had never known that in his, you know, in his temporal life. Mm-hmm. And then he said, because his mother had been martyred for her faith, and so he then became an orphan. And so he is standing there saying to this congregation, now he his skin color is different than everybody there. His age was dramatically different than everyone else there. But, you know, he's a Christian, and he is, through tears, saying, we share the same Father, and you are my sisters and brothers. And he's looking at these older women, and he is saying, and I need a mother. And it transformed the life of that one congregation. And so I do think that when young people are able to identify and vocalize their need, the church does rise up to be who she's supposed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's just a wonderfully vivid story. Thanks for sharing that with us. And in our growing young research, we encountered folks who had, you know, a similar experience with the church. And one of the things that struck us as we analyzed the data is, while we started by trying to identify how churches are changing young people, what we also saw is that young people change churches. So, you know, it's not just young people who need and want that experience of family. All generations need and want that experience of family. And as churches are more intentional in prioritizing young people and building relationships with young people, it's not just the young people who benefit. All generations benefit. You know, churches would report to us that they have now, as they've done a better job being focused in on young people, they have more vitality, more energy, more innovation, more creativity. I mean, they just went on and on how involving young people and building relationships with young people transformed the whole congregation. So, you know, in your story, it's not just that young man who benefits. It's every other person who's investing in him, who's experiencing the church as a more generative family because he's in their lives too.
Absolutely. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Reconnect. We're talking with Dr. Kara Powell from Fuller Seminary's Youth Institute. The book that we're discussing is Growing Young, Six Essential Strategies to Help Young People Discover and Love Your Church. You can find it information about it at churchesgrowingyoung.org. Kara, I love what you just talked about there in terms of young people changing churches. And, you know, that word change, that can sometimes be really scary. Uh-huh. And I think that sometimes we can be, the older we get, the more resistant we are to change. Uh-huh. And when we talk about family, we all recognize that we put up with a whole lot more inside of our family systems than we would put up with the casual other person. So I think that the family notion there is really important as well. One of the things you guys talk about is the church being more like a family room. And that means allowing these young people to move the furniture, right? So not just the physical furniture, but like moving the furniture of in terms of what we do or how we do things. And so talk about that a little bit and talk about it in terms of what they're not looking for is to change or move necessarily our theological positions, but other parts of the way we express church in life.
Yeah, you know, when we use the phrase trying to move church away from being a theater to a family room, what's at the heart of that is a lot of churches are pretty focused with their worship services on a performance, and it can feel like, you know, the audience is the spectator, and we're watching paid and volunteer pastors and worship leaders, put on a show for us. And, you know, that's the furthest thing from the image of the church that's in the New Testament. And so, you know, the idea of the family room is that we're all creating this. We're all a part. And we can be authentic and vulnerable about who we are, and we can celebrate each other's contributions. And so you're right. You know, young people ask phenomenal questions and have great insights that if we take the time to listen to them, we are going to be the better for it. My husband actually just had breakfast this morning with our church's worship pastor, and I'm at a 120-year-old church that is 5,000 people. So it's no one would accuse our church of being quick to change. But what was interesting is my husband was relaying to me how our worship pastor is prioritizing spending time, and he's probably in his 50s, he's prioritizing spending time with college students these days because he wants to understand what they are hungry for in worship, how they're experiencing what we offer, what they would love to tweak. And I just applaud this, you know, very accomplished very well-recognized musician and worship leader to say, because he's saying, I want to understand this generation. So one of our recommendations in our Growing Young book is, you know, when you want to make change, it starts with understanding or empathizing with young people. And it starts with, for a church leader, for a parent, for a volunteer, to go out to coffee with one or two young people and just ask questions like, what do you love about our church? What would you want to change about it? What drew you here? What do you tell your friends about our church? What do you think your friends would love or not love about our church if they came? And through those conversations, churches can learn so much more about what young people are hungry for. And those are the kinds of insights that help them make those key changes.
So I have a bunch of 22-year-olds in my life right now because
awesome.
I have one of them in my house, and I cook, and so they know that, and so I generally have a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having a big late breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and two of them were just expressing how excited they were about the church that they had found and where they were worshiping, and they'd been going for, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks at that point, and they were looking forward to it, and the things that they were talking about and expressing were not at all the questions that I would ask if I were going looking for a church. And so, you know, I listened, and then I finally said, because I know the pastor there, and I love him. And so I said, well, you know, what do you think about so-and-so's sermons? And they just looked at me, and I said, well, I mean, because I love him, and I've read his books, and da-da-da, they just looked at me. They don't even know who the pastor is.
Yeah.
Right? Because that is not at all the way they are connecting in the life of that congregation at this point.
Yeah.
So, I love this conversation, and I love what you're doing. Folks, this is Dr. Kara Powell. She's at Fuller Seminary's Youth Institute, and she is helping us and churches reconnect with young people. The target group that they looked at is 15 to 29-year-olds, and they have researched what 250 churches where young people are actively engaged, churches that are not just attractional for young people, but really doing a good job in terms of equipping them. And so you got to go check out what she's doing, fulleryouthinstitute.org, and you can find information about the book at churchesgrowingyoung.org. Kara, let's talk about some of those questions, because oftentimes the church is answering questions that young people are not asking, and we're not answering the questions that they are asking.
Yeah.
So what do you hear young adults and teenagers asking that maybe we're not hearing them ask?
Yeah, great question. So part of what I love about being a faculty member at Fuller Seminary is we're a very interdisciplinary school. So in the midst of studying these 250 churches that are growing young, we've also spent a lot of time with our theology and psychology faculty members. And I've come to conclude that young people today are asking three big questions. They're asking, number one, who am I, which is a question of identity. They're asking, number two, where do I fit, which is a question of belonging. And they're asking, number three, what difference do I make, which is a question of purpose. So identity, belonging, purpose, those are the three major quests of young people today. And what's distressing and so sad is that young people often come up with toxic answers to those questions, answers that might bring some kind of short-term sense of satisfaction, but ultimately fail in the long run. And the gospel is the best and really only long-term answer to those questions. Our question of identity, who are we? We are ultimately people who are saved by God's grace. Where do we belong? We ultimately belong best in the midst of a Christ-centered community showing God's love. And then thirdly, you know, where's our sense of purpose come from? It comes from being involved in God's mission and seeing God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And so, you know, the churches that we studied who are doing the most amazing work are really sensitive to those three questions and are coming up with creative ways to help young people see how the gospel meets their deepest needs. And, you know, these churches are also recognizing that all of us are on this identity, belonging, purpose journey. You know, I am far from being in the 15 to 29-year-old age group, but truly every day my attitudes and my actions are shaped by my own identity, belonging, purpose purpose journey. And that gives me a point of connection with young people. Now, granted, their experience is different than mine. So, you know, we recommend that leaders and parents avoid the phrase, quote, when I was your age, end quote, because there are a lot of differences in our culture today. But the core human tasks haven't changed much in the last handful of generations here in the U.S. They ultimately relate to our longing for identity, belonging, and purpose, which is best met through Jesus Christ.
Mm. And I love that you've offered that, because I think that some of the pushback we always get in conversations about, particularly when the two words come together, attractional and church, the pushback we always get is doctrinal, it's theological. And what you're saying is we do not in any way, shape, or form have to give up or compromise the gospel in any of this. In fact, if we would do a better job being gospel-centered people, this would all come much more easily to us.
Yeah. It's so true. And I think really being clear on what the gospel is and what the gospel isn't. And, you know, it's all too common for churches today to have a slightly or maybe significantly distorted understanding of the gospel. And of the 1,300 interviews we did during the course of our growing young research, the one that most vividly stands out to me was with a young woman in her late 20s who was at an amazing congregation doing awesome work with 20-somethings. And so, you know, we had vetted these questions. 8 faculty from Fuller Seminary, including me, had reviewed these questions, signed off on them. And one of the questions was, how would you define Christianity? And so the PhD student from Fuller who was conducting the interview asked this young woman this question, how would you define Christianity? And she basically said, well, I don't really know how to define Christianity, but can I tell you who Jesus is and what Jesus means in my life? And, you know, that was that young woman's drop the mic moment. And she took us as Fuller faculty to school because she identified something that we hadn't quite seen, is that, you know, ultimately, really, how you define Christianity boils down to what she understood, who Jesus is and what Jesus has done in your life. And that was one of the other of the 6 core commitments that we identified, is these churches were ruthless at focusing on Jesus' message, focusing on the grace and love of Jesus Christ, which is ultimately what separates Christianity from every other religion. And it's all too easy to let behavioralism and kind of a, you know, try harder mentality taint our teaching and our understanding of the gospel. But in these churches, they were doing such a good job peeling away those layers and just and keeping young people first and foremost focused on Jesus Christ.
Hey, folks, the voice that you're hearing is Dr. Kara Powell. She is a professor at Fuller Seminary. You can find information about what she's talking about today at fulleryouthinstitute.org and about the book at a website, churchesgrowingyoung.org. The book is Growing Young, and it's designed to equip Christians, churches, to consider and maybe even reconsider the ways in which we think about and engage with this cohort of people who are 15 to 29 years old. I think that so often, Dr. Powell, we think about doing ministry to or for them, as opposed to fully integrating into their lives, having them be integrated into the life of the church, where it really is a mutual experience of being the church instead of the church doing ministry to or for a group of people.
Yeah, it really needs to be the church doing ministry with them. You nailed it. It's not about to or for. It's how we do ministry with them. And, you know, there's a developmental difference between, say, a 15-year-old and a 25-year-old and what that looks like. But, again, think about young people's desire for a sense of purpose, a sense of identity, and how can we help young people really use their gifts and passions within the church. One of our other of the 6 core commitments is what we call keychain leadership. And in these 250 churches that were growing young, leaders across the board did a wonderful job recognizing the keys of authority and power and influence they had, not necessarily literal keys, but metaphorical keys of authority, power, and influence, and then handing those over to young people. So, you know, whether it's a young person who loves technology and is somehow involved in technology in the church, whether it's a young person who has musical skills or artistic skills who's helping lead worship in the youth ministry, college ministry, or the overall congregation. Whether it's a young person with a great ability to think strategically who gets invited into top level, you know, high level church leadership discussions.
Hey, Dr. Powell, we gotta leave it right there. We're gonna have to get the book, folks. The book is Growing Young. This is The Reconnect. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we are certainly worshiping the holy name of the Lord our God. We are blessed to be counted among his disciples and his followers, and we are seeking to get God back into the conversations of the day. So we not only talk about what people are talking about, we like to talk with the people who are talking about the stuff that we all ought to be talking about. And so that means that today, here on The Reconnect, I am bringing you Billy Hollowell. Now, we have talked to Billy before in his role as the senior editor of FaithWire News, and you can follow them on Twitter at FaithWire News. He's a former reporter at Deseret News. He's a faith editor and assistant editor at The Blaze. He's contributed to The Washington Post, The Daily Caller, The Huffington Post. Actually, his list of places now that he has spoken is too long to even enumerate to you, because he's also the author of a few books, and the latest one is the one we're going to talk about today, and it's pretty extraordinary. It's entitled Fault Line: How a Seismic Shift in Culture is Threatening Free Speech and Shaping the Next Generation. So you can find the book online at HollowellFaultLineBook.com, and you can follow Billy on Twitter at Billy Hollowell. Billy, welcome to the Reconnect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's just jump right in. What are the fault lines in our culture, and what do you mean when you use what I consider a very destabilizing seismic reference?
So basically, you know, when you look at where we are culturally right now, there's sort of this chaos going on. And I think a lot of us felt this for the last couple of years specifically, although this has been coming for a long time. And in the midst of this chaos, there's a loss of truth. And so that is what this seismic shift is, that culturally, and we see this in polls. You can look at the Barna Group, and I go through all of this in Faultline in detail. But you look at these polls that have asked Americans, you know, is truth relative? And it's fascinating. You have so many people unable to say that they believe there's a solid truth. You know, majorities of Americans will say, oh, well, you can find truth inside of yourselves. And cultures need to decide for themselves what is right and true. All of that is part of this seismic shift. We are no longer having this cultural reference point. You know, the Judeo-Christian values that we've cherished for so long, a lot of that is eroding. And so a lot of what I cover in Faultline are the reasons why that is happening. How did we get here? Why are we in this place of moral confusion? And so, you know, my theory has been for a long time, in looking at all of the different places that we learn from and all the different places we get information from, that Hollywood, the media, and universities, that's Hollywood, the media, and universities have contributed to this problem and have actually brought us to the point where we are.
All right, Hollywood, media, and universities, you know, that's like a trio of easy targets at some level, right, for Christians. Like, we're
Absolutely.
Used to hurling criticism in their direction. But I want to back up to something that you just said, and I want you to unpack it a little bit further, because you basically describe us as having lost our cultural reference points. You use the word chaos. When you use the word chaos, man, I'm thinking before there was order, right? And there's just chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And we've moved from a time period when people may have felt like the world was well ordered and their own lives were well ordered and our culture was well ordered. But what you describe is a seismic shift from that along these fault lines. Because morally, when you say we've lost truth, it's not that the truth has gone away, it's that our connection to it has somehow eroded away. So talk about that meltdown. Talk about that, how that happened.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think one of the big things that, and this is sort of from a 30,000-foot level, but think about the last 10 to 15 years, the explosion of technology, right? We've got smartphones, we have tablets, we have computers in our face all the time, and Hollywood content, entertainment content, news content, you know, if there's a bias in those areas, which I believe there is, and we can talk deeper about that, you know, we are inundated with this. And millennials in particular, and this is the group that we should be most concerned with, because millennials, people 18 to 35, I'm 33 years old, so I'm on the upper end of that. You know, we've been hit with these messages incessantly because we grew up with all of that technology, right? So we also are the generation where 30% plus, up towards 40% of our generation, we're non-believers. We're unaffiliated. We're either atheist, agnostic, or we just don't embrace a faith. And so the reason for that, I believe, is because we've just been hit with these messages of secularism over and over and over. And we can see this specifically when you get into different issues. Even divorce, the topic of divorce, Gallup asks people every year, where do you stand? You know, is this morally acceptable? And they list out a variety of things. Over 70% of Americans more generally, not just millennials, think that divorce is morally acceptable now. And I'm not making these numbers up. I have them in the book. This is what Gallup looks at every year. We can go down the line, having babies out of wedlock. I think it's 67% of the country thinks that that's morally acceptable. Sex before marriage, you know, all of these things, because we've been hit. I mean, you look at entertainment, you can't even turn on primetime TV at night without being afraid for what your kids are going to see. This has become the new norm, and it's reinforced in all of the areas where we learn in society outside of the church. So if you're not going to church, and this has become a bigger thing for people who are millennials especially, your influence points shrink down to those areas many times.
Mm. All right, now you're scaring me a little bit. Friends, we're talking with Billy Hollowell. You know him as the senior editor of FaithWire.com. You can follow them on Twitter at FaithWire News, and I recommend you do so because they post all kinds of, like, really good news items, and I love that. But we're talking today about his new book, Fault Line, How a Seismic Shift in Culture is Threatening Free Speech and Shaping the Next Generation. And Billy, I want to talk about that next generation, because that's where you really, you know, that's really, you really spend your time there in terms of their views about religion, morality, values. I would have suspected that that generation would actually be more open-minded. Tell me if that's what we're seeing.
I think, you know, millennials are really complicated because there's a level of compassion there, I think, for other human beings that might not have been as present. Not that other generations weren't compassionate, but millennials, you know, you talk to some pastors, they'll tell you it's really easy to get a millennial to go on a missions trip, right? But it's a lot harder once you start getting into the deep theological stuff to get them to sort of come on and understand and embrace it. I think there's a huge opportunity. You know, this is doom and gloom, a lot of what we're talking about. And to a degree, it should be. We have a serious cultural problem that we have allowed as Christians and or conservatives, because conservatives have very similar arguments about these areas that we're talking about as Christians do. We've allowed this to fester. But there is an opportunity to bring people in. You know, the gospel can never really be stopped, right? It's the gospel. So, you know, when we talk doom and gloom, we have to remember that. But we have to understand that we have a generation that does have an openness for loving others and does have an openness for going out there and doing kind things for people. So those are very important basic sentiments of Christianity as well, of trying to live like Jesus. And so I think we can obviously bring millennials in, but we have to market the messages properly to them. And that's one of the big problems here. There's an absence. I think, you know, the church especially has done a little bit of a disservice in not keeping up and engaging in the ways that it needs to bring millennials and, you know, others younger than millennials, Generation Z, into the fold.
Mm. Okay, so you made a distinction there. I don't know if you were even aware, because you sort of made it as a side comment. But for my listeners, it's a really important distinction, and I'd like for you to make it a little more finely. You actually made a distinction about or between conservatives in America and people operating out of a distinctly Christian worldview. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, and it's important that we distinguish those things. There are a lot of Christians who do not want to necessarily, but they may be more conservative on a lot of indicators. They don't necessarily want to be folded into a political label. And the reason in the book, I bring them together in some ways is because, again, those arguments are the same. When we talk about Hollywood media universities, the feelings are the same, being underrepresented, misrepresented, not being framed properly, having morality pushed, you know, on them, or immorality in their view pushed on them. For those two groups, there's a lot of similarities. But I think we need to distinguish the two as well, especially in the times that we're living in right now with Donald Trump and all the controversy surrounding that, and where people believe, you know, evangelicals stand or where they should stand on that. So, you know, there is an important distinction there. And I think when we're talking about the gospel, we have to be extra careful. And when we're talking about making sure that those messages are, that the goodness of the gospel is presented by having people engaged. You know, on the flip side, conservatives also have to do a similar thing. They have to engage in Hollywood, engage in media, and engage in universities with the values that they care about. So I guess to boil that down, there are very similar values that are embraced. And I would say a solid chunk, maybe even a majority, obviously, of Christians might tend to be more conservative, but we have to be careful about just throwing them all into one pot, I think.
Okay, folks, I'm talking to Billy Hollowell. We're talking about Fault Line, which is his new book. And Billy, I'm actually going to read you a couple of quotes from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito that he made recently to some Catholic attorneys, because I think that engaging you in a conversation about what he said helps us get to a conversation about where America is headed and how we as Christians and or conservatives need to be responding. So he actually repeated some words that he wrote in his dissent in the Obergefell case, which legalized homosexual marriage, for my listeners who aren't up to speed on, you know, if I just drop Obergefell out there. So he told the group that he suspected that the decision would, quote, vilify those who disagree and treat them as bigots. And he said this the other night, we are seeing this coming to pass. And then he said, the wind is picking up. It is hostile to those with traditional moral beliefs. And then he went on to say, we are likely to see pitched battles in courts and Congress, state legislatures and town halls. But the most important fight for the hearts is for the hearts and minds of our fellow Americans. And it's up to all of us to, this is an interesting word for a Supreme Court justice to use, evangelize our fellow Americans about the issue of religious freedom.
Yeah,
I'm inviting you to interact with that. Yeah, it's an incredible quote.
Incredibly powerful. It's powerful in that, and I think as we're talking about this, the point of Fault Line was to present, a lot of books just rant and rave about the problem. And so a good chunk of the book focuses on the problem with the data and the stats and the info to help people have these discussions and arguments, right? But the other portion is exactly what he's speaking about, the warning of where we're headed and what is going on. There are a couple of things, you know, in relation to these quotes that are very important. If we allow the out-of-control culture to continue without engaging, what we are seeing happen now is we have bakers who are being fined $135,000. We have business, you know, Christian business owners being put out of business, wedding vendors and all of that. There's a very real free speech issue here and a very real religious freedom issue here because people are not being educated properly. And it is interesting that he used the word evangelize, because I think a better word is just educate, right? But I think it carries with it that level of fervency that we need to actually do this. When we talk about evangelizing somebody, it is changing their worldview, their perspective. And I think the problem is that big. The gap in education in the media, Hollywood, and universities is that big that we have to do that, right? We have to evangelize instead of just, you know, benignly educating people, because what is at stake here are real First Amendment rights, everything down to college campuses and what people can say and do there, to a business owner and whether or not they're going to be able to operate in the way that is in line with their conscience. So there are very big issues here. And I thought his quotes, you know, I saw them the other day. We did a report on them. I thought they were very, very important points to be made about where we are and where we're headed if we don't do something about it.
All right, folks, so when Billy says we reported on that the other day, he's talking about faithwire.com, which is a great place for you to visit and grab some good news stories and some positive interpretation of the news of the day. But you also need to read specifically chapters 16 and 17 on this particular subject of free speech and religious liberty in Billy's new book, Fault Line, How a Seismic Shift in Culture is Threatening Free Speech and Shaping the Next Generation. Billy, it is always great to talk with you, and you and I follow each other on Twitter, and so you should be prepared for this next question, because I warned you in advance I'd be asking it. Your kids like to throw clothes, both clean and dirty, into the tub, and they like to do it sometimes when there's water in there and sometimes not. Is this a problem that you have solved at your home?
No, and it's actually graduated. My 19-month-old, we've had a huge klepto problem here that we joke about. Things are going missing. My planner went missing. Luckily, it didn't end up in the tub. And after 2 hours of searching, I found it stuffed in a bin in her bedroom. And then my Apple Watch went missing for 2 days, and we found it stuffed in the DVD case under DVDs. So the other thing she likes to do is throw the clothing and throw her bottles. And she could be drinking a milk bottle that ends up in the bathtub. It is just the go-to place for some reason. And she particularly loves it when it is filled with water. You will see all of the dirty clothes. She will rush to get them and throw them in. So it has not been solved. I don't know if anybody has advice, but feel free to tweet it to me.
So I mentioned this to my mom because I thought it was so funny. And she said, he needs to get those kids a washboard. So I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of an old-fashioned washboard, but I'm now looking for one for your kids.
I love it. Well, and that's the thing. She's the best listener for a 19-month-old. She listens to everything, but when it comes to – she loves to misplace things, but the bathtub is like her place. So it's hilarious. She also tries to grab, like, clean diapers and throw them in. I mean, it's just an endless barrage of things in the bathtub. So whenever we're missing something, that's where we first look now.
That's just hilarious. All right, friends, he's Billy Hollowell. You should follow him on Twitter. It's a humorous time, at Billy Hollowell. Billy, thanks so much for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. It's the time in the show where I like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you bring God back into the conversation in really tangible ways. And so I thought, since I had Billy on today, that I would just grab some stories right off of faithwire.com to give you a sense of the flavor of the things that's on there. And it's also an opportunity for us to just be reminded of the good news, that there are good news stories out there. I've got a friend who I met this morning for coffee, and she basically, one of the things that she's concerned about is that we as Christians, man, we are wringing our hands and we are cataloging the bad news of what's happening in the culture, and we're not often telling the stories of redemption. We're not often telling the testimonies of people who are being healed and saved and redeemed by the power of the gospel. So I just thought today we would do that. And so the first one I bring to you is entitled Olympic Skater Scott Hamilton Reveals Spectacular Miracle Surrounding Battle with His Third Brain Tumor. So everybody in America knows who Scott Hamilton is. And so it's no secret that he's an Olympic skater. It's also no secret to those of us who pay close attention that he and his wife have a very colorful family that includes children who are adopted from foreign countries. It's also no secret that he has battled cancer and pituitary tumors many times over the course of his life. He now says that he's been the recipient of, in his own words, a spectacular miracle. So he was diagnosed with his last brain tumor, or a brain tumor, the third time, last summer. And he it basically, here's the end of the story. It shrunk. It shrunk without any treatment. So he says, this is Scott Hamilton in his own words, the nature of tumors is that they grow. Without treatment, they have no reason to shrink. So I was the recipient of a spectacular miracle, he told People magazine. I'm keeping an eye on it. There's no treatment needed at this time. He said that he was absolutely shocked when he was told in February that doctors would not need to do surgery and would instead simply monitor the situation. He said that he asked his doctors if they had any explanation. And he says their response left me pretty emotional. It was funny. The surgeon that I would have used if I had to take it out, that's where I went. And I said to him, can you explain this? And he just smiled and he looked at me and he said, God, that's it. Whoa, he says, I was just a blubbering mess. I just kept saying, I'm not worthy of this. Now, as for the practical steps that he took in terms of his own own way of responding to his cancer diagnosis, he wants people to know that he's cut out sugar and other unhealthy foods, and that he consumes lots of water, supplements, and essential oils. He's obviously also a very fit guy. So the doctors told him, hey, keep doing whatever you're doing, but basically God's the one who did this. And this is a testimony not only to the healing power of God, but he goes on to give an incredibly powerful testimony about the faith that he shares with his wife and her faithfulness to simply put this before the Lord in the attitude of prayer when he was diagnosed. He says, I told her, you know, that I'd gotten my diagnosis, and she just grabbed my hands and started praying. And he talks about it being just one of the most beautiful moments in their life together. All right, I got another one for you from faithwire.com. This is a testimony about a novelist. He is you probably know him because he's a New York Times best-selling author. His name is Andrew Clavin, and he has on faithwire.com a powerful story of his own conversion to Christianity. So I'll just read you a bit of the background here. It says, award-winning novelist Andrew Clavin spent the bulk of his life as a self-described secular Jew. And then he embarked on a 35-year journey toward discovering his faith, and that led him eventually to embrace Jesus. He's the author of The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. And he believes that secularism dominates many spheres of influence in America today. And he said that's having a profound impact on our population. Here's a quote. Everyone is living right now very far away from faith. The default idea, especially among those who sometimes might be called leaders or thought leaders, is that every sane, smart, sophisticated person is an atheist. If you're not an atheist, there's something weird about you. And if you're a Christian, you must be a rube. A rube is not a good thing, by the way. If you're not familiar with that term, it's It's not a nice thing to call another person a rube. Klavan continued, I think that has a very powerful effect on what people think, even before they know what they think. So you have heard me say before that one of the critical things that we have to do is we have to be thinking about what we're thinking about. And that's the issue that he's addressing here. Secularism is so pervasive. It's so pervasive in media. It's so pervasive in what we take in through through what Hollywood produces. Secularism is so pervasive in our schools. It's so pervasive in our healthcare and in the options afforded us through medical technology. Secularism is pervasive in most conversations and in most contexts, and certainly in our government. And so if that's the water that you're swimming in, why would you ever think about something else? Well, the only reason you would ever think about something else is if someone came along to introduce some other idea into that conversation. Klavan says that discovering Christianity led him to a place in which his entire perspective changed. He says, after about 5 years, I saw that my life had actually changed massively for the better. I said to God, thank you. What can I do for you? Klavan recalled, it seemed like a stupid question because he's God and I'm a schmo. But Klavan went on to say, I was not ready for the response I received. Almost immediately, these words were perfectly formed in my mind. Remember, he's just asked God, thank you. What can I do for you? These words perfectly formed in my mind, he said, you should be baptized. He said, noting that at the time, that was the furthest thing from his own mind, and despite some challenges that it caused in his life and in his family, he said that's exactly what he did. And his faith has been growing over subsequent years. He talks about, in conclusion here, he talks about the fact that secularism is actually an incorrect way of thinking. He said, in just a little bit of independent thought, with just a little bit of logic, with just a little bit of information, you will be led to certain conclusions that will, at the very least, make Christianity seem very plausible. Folks, that's the entry point. Like, we just have to get people to the point where they even think Christianity is at least plausible. In the world of secularism and in the world of secular thought, Christianity is not even plausible. So you and I have a challenge before us. The winds may be stiff against us, but we have other Christians out there who are making the case for Christ in very, very significant ways and with great boldness. And the third thing that I pulled off of faithwire.com today is one of those folks. If you're a person who is on social media and sort of in your feed are other Christians and Christian testimonies, then you have probably already seen the video of Sam Alberry. Okay, Sam Alberry is a pastor at St. Mary's Maidenhead in the UK. You got to go and you got to Google this guy and you got to hear his testimony. He's a same-sex attracted pastor, but he breaks down a traditional marriage and a defense of it in a way that you and I need to use in our own conversations with same-sex attracted individuals. All right, folks, that's all we got time for today. It's always great to be with you. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.